Hello, I'm Garni Barkajarian of the Pacific Neuroscience Institute and CNS member for more than 10 years. What I love most about being a member is access to cutting-edge science and the opportunities that have advanced my career. I've also gained new colleagues and lifelong friends. Being a CNS member has been so rewarding. The value of membership cannot be defined by a number. Join me and the over 10,000 neurosurgeons who are making a difference in the world. Visit cns.org/membership podcast today.
Welcome everyone to another thrilling edition of the CNS Journal Club podcast. My name is Brian Solway, and I'm the fourth year neurosurgery resident at Medical University of South Carolina. And I'm thankful to be back behind the microphone to moderate this month's episode. Today we'll be discussing the newly published article titled Real-Time Intraoperative Ultrasound Using a Minimally Invasive Transducer During Anterior Cervical Spine Surgery. I can't wait to jump into this article that explores how we can improve upon a procedure that all neurosurgeons are quite familiar with, the anterior cervical surgery, through the innovative use of a similarly familiar technology, intraoperative ultrasound. As always, we are joined with some incredible guests that are transforming and pushing the field of neurosurgery forward. To get us started, I'd like to have our guests introduce themselves. First, we're privileged to have the first author of this study, Dr. Timothy Chrysikos. Dr. Chrysikos, do you mind introducing yourself?
Thanks, Dr. Solway. It's a real honor to join you and here today. I'm an assistant professor of neurosurgery at the University of Maryland. I completed my neurosurgery residency also here at Maryland. And last year, completed a fellowship in spine surgery at UCSF. And, my interest in ultrasound, you know, very similar to you, is really started when I was a resident. And I'd be happy to, share just a few slides, just kind of show some of the work that we did at Maryland that's kind of led us to where we are. It's really one of my current partners and Ken Crandall first showed me the use of ultrasound during spine surgery. Ken also, like me, trained at Maryland, and then he completed a fellowship at the University of Miami. And Miami is really one of the pioneering institutions for use of ultrasound. I think you look back at the early publications since the 80s. Miami has been a real pioneer. So Ken brought that with him. And this is just a small case series where we did, during spinal deformity surgery, during pedicle subtraction osteotomy. And we felt like we found a good use for ultrasound during this procedure, fit well within the sequences of surgery. You can see here on the left, any deformity surgeon is acutely aware of when you reduce that osteotomy wedge, you can one of the risks is a neurologic injury, and you can have change in neuromonitoring signals. And again, also very aware when you reduce that wedge, invariably you're going to get this wrinkle or this kink on the thecal sac. But you still may have some underlying uncertainty about the status of the cord. So, we got this picture. You can see that wrinkle there. And, despite that, the morphology of the cord is very nice and healthy. And in one case, we did have a transient change in our SSEP. But bringing in the ultrasound gave us, confidence that the integrity of the cord was intact. Essentially left the amount of deformity correction as such, and our signals returned, and this patient had a good outcome. And so, what we did next is we decided to, bring that next door over to shock trauma, and working with great mentors like Dr. Bijan Arabi has had a, throughout his whole career, a real emphasis on adequacy of decompression in patients with spinal cord injury. So we were able to bring ultrasound here as well and see, you know, we essentially were in this publication, also in the Red Journal 2023, were wanted to compare our intraoperative judgment of adequacy of decompression with postoperative MRI. And, you know, the ultrasound was quite good. What we found, though, in the setting of spinal cord injury is, you know, some patients would go on to have inadequate decompression on their postoperative MRI, despite our judgment of good decompression during surgery. You can see what we found is that those cases, not surprisingly, tend to be the more severely injured spinal cord injury with long intramedullary lesion length, patients that are going to go on to swell, either having inadequate decompression at the rostral and caudal ends of the laminectomy bed, or in those cases, a very severe swelling, and that intradural complete obliteration of the CSF space intradurally. So, you know, certainly another question emerges from this is does ultrasound have a role to play in helping us make the decision on whether patients would benefit from an expansion duraplasty? And I think it likely does. But in 10% of the cases, and these were all done from a posterior approach, you know, the ultrasound did prompt us to perform additional laminectomy to try to guarantee that adequacy of decompression. And it really is from here, the segue from here to the current paper is, you know, you can see on that bottom case that corpectomy, remember multiple times trying to bring our ultrasound transducer, both the cranial probe and the hockey stick, and just not being able to acquire good images from an anterior approach. So then move on to UCSF and was delighted to find out that they had a state-of-the-art ultrasound apparatus with one of these newer minimally invasive transducers. And so we had the idea, and it was great, great support, and it was great to do this work with Dr. Praveen Mumineni and Dr. Lee Tan, my two mentors from fellowship. And, you know, that essentially led to the paper we discussed today. You know, we used it during anterior cervical spine surgery, but we were also able to use it during tubular microdiscectomy as well. We're able to get, you know, this is just a single case operative case presentation, but we were able to get generate images both before and after lumbar microdiscectomy. You can see I've outlined here. So I'll unshare now, and I'll turn it back over to you.
Yeah, let me get this going. Well, thank you for that introduction. I mean, it's great to hear your journey through ultrasound. And I really do recommend our listeners and viewers to check out this article, not only for the incredible figures, but you also have a great video associated with it that really shows this thing in action. But before we get into the questions, I want to go ahead and introduce the rest of our guests. We are joined by our guest interviewer today, Dr. Mohamed Abdelbar from Duke, who is a prominent thought leader in the field of spine surgery. Dr. Abdelbar, do you mind introducing yourself to our listeners?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It's a great honor, and really excited about this podcast, as well as talking about this very important subject. I'm an associate professor of neurosurgery and orthopedics at Duke. I'm also the spine fellowship co-director. I specialize in ultra minimally invasive spine surgery, including endoscopic and awake surgery.
Great, thank you. And last but certainly not least, we have the co-chair of the CNS Journal Club podcast, the venerable Dr. Rafael Vega. For our new listeners joining the podcast, Dr. Vega, do you mind introducing yourself before we discuss the article?
So I'm Rafael, and I've been here co-moderating and co-chairing this podcast now for almost 5 years. But this topic is very exciting, and I can't wait to get into it. So go forward.
Yeah, thank you all for your introductions. We clearly have a great group here, well-equipped to discuss this newly published article. Dr. Christkos, you went through kind of your introduction and your path to getting to this study. If you don't mind just taking us through the key findings and perhaps we can pull up some of the images while you discuss that.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So this all really started out of can we use this small profile transducer to capture images of the spinal cord and surrounding anatomy? And what wasn't expecting to find was how good the visualization, not just of the spinal cord was, but of the nerve root sleeve and the proximal aspect of the exiting nerve root and as well as the surrounding bone and soft tissue. So we utilized this ultrasound transducer in 26 levels in 17 different patients. One case of cervical corpectomy, which we also present with figures, as well as a case of cervical disc arthroplasty. And essentially what we were trying to do is essentially a proof of concept. Can we visualize important neural and anatomy using this approach? And then secondarily to that, did the findings in real time during surgery influence us as surgeons to change the surgery in any way? So essentially, standard ACDF approach, for instance, perform the dissection, remove the ventral osteophytes, we would place distraction pins, complete the discectomy and removal of the dorsal osteophytes with a high speed burr, and then perform an initial round of foraminotomy. And essentially to perform that such that we were satisfied with the decompression based on direct visualization with the microscope, as well as our tactile assessment with the Karesen and upgoing curette. And at that point, we brought the ultrasound in to assess our work. And what we we recorded those instances, and it was considerably higher than what we were initially expecting. Like we said, of those 27 levels, around 40%, we either performed additional decompression, either an additional round of foraminotomy, using the ultrasound to target an osteophyte to remove, for instance, that we left behind. in one case, despite all of our efforts, could not, due to the severity of the foraminal stenosis, performed a complete uncinectomy in order to get adequate decompression. And then also, I think equally importantly, those cases that where we had planned to perform an uncinectomy, after distraction and foraminotomy checking with the ultrasound, we felt very content that the nerve root was nicely decompressed. And so we elected not to perform uncinectomy in two cases. So this is essentially an initial experience with this approach and what the surgeon's judgment was using it.
Thank you for that introduction. Certainly innovating over there with ultrasound, and it's great to see these incredible images. I'd like to now open it up to our guest interviewer, Dr. Abdel Barr, if you happen to have any questions for the author.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, you should be congratulated about this great work, and not just this paper, but the body of work that you've shown previous to that. I think that, I think it's really showing, the power of ultrasound. So one of my first questions was, what was the path to thinking of this. And it seems like this ultrasound is something that is used in pituitary surgery. Is that correct?
Yeah, I believe that this instrument, I believe, was initially designed for transphenoidal surgery, and it still is used for that approach. And this is sort of taking this and trying to redeploy it in another surgical setting.
So for our listeners and so on, was this a matter of you being in a transphenoidal surgery and saying, hey, this is kind of interesting? Or was it the opposite, that you were looking for a solution and somebody came up to that? Because I think that's really important, for young, listeners and so on. How do we come up with these innovative answers to dilemmas that we have?
Yeah, I think so. I had not actually used this for transphenoidal surgery as a resident. This was really prompted by my research looking around at what the available equipment was on the market to see if there was some kind of transducer available that could overcome the shortcomings of the other transducers I'd used that was prohibitive for trying to get pictures from the front of the spine.
And the dimensions are 7 millimeters by 6 millimeters at the distal end?
That's correct, yes. So the height is 6 millimeters of the transducer. And as I said, starting fellowship at UCSF, it was really just very fortuitous that they had the very instrument I was hoping one day to be able to use. And so that's how that came about.
Do you mind if I ask something? So there's a burr hole like ultrasound probe that's out there, right? That's kind of thin, does not have the best resolution per se, right? But could potentially fit in that situation. Did you guys try that?
Yeah, we've tried a number of the different transducers. For me personally, I have not tried the burr hole cover transducer, but I think that's a great question, and I would like to try it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the thing is, not everybody has this one, right? And I know that there's different companies that try to sell different probes, and again, for if you're at a center that's lucky to have such a thing, it's great, but some might have the other one hanging around, but I don't know, like the quality of images that we see from this on your paper are really nice. I don't always see that, So.
And I think you can, if is the, and by no means is this the first experience using ultrasound during anterior cervical surgery. There's other authors have been writing about this since the late 80s, but the publications are quite sparse. But they tended to use larger transducer size. For me and for many surgeons, I really like to have a distraction system in place. If you're going to do that, it's those larger transducers are really not applicable.
Yeah, I'd like to echo what Dr. Vega was saying. That I mean, the resolution of the figures it's quite impressive. I mean, I'm curious to see, was it the first time you put the probe in there, it was just like, hallelujah, this is an amazing image, or did it require some learning curve and adjustments and figuring out how to really maximize the image quality?
I think the really from the very first use, the image quality was really surprisingly good. I think as far as the learning curve, we'd had a bit of experience from using ultrasound in the way most of us are used to it from posterior approach. So had some familiarity with basic sonographic anatomy, the appearance of the spinal cord, subarachnoid space, et cetera. And that's really, again, that's been described 40 years ago. We have, again, those early pioneers at Miami, and then doctors Dorman and Rubin in Chicago. But I think part of it is in most cases, you can even situate this within the intervertebral space or at the proximal aspect of it. And I think that does facilitate you know, really good quality images. And then there's also some maneuverability as well, as far as angling it to be able to look out the exiting nerve root.
Thank you. And sorry, Dr. Abdelbar, I think I may have jumped in.
No problem at all. You know, not to be a critic, but, you know, some people say, well, you know, you completed these foraminotomies and in 40% you did more work. You know, one criticism could...
That 40% also includes several cases in which we did less. But you're correct. So, most of the time we did do more. You're correct.
So, you know, one criticism may be that, you know, you're kind of overdoing it. And, you know, I can't imagine that, you know, 30 to 40% of your patients wake up with a continued radiculopathy. So maybe the decompressions that we're doing are, quote unquote, good enough, you know, and part of ACDF surgery is, you know, when we put the, you know, whatever you put in there as an allograft or something else, you know, some dependence on indirect decompression. Have you thought about doing, you know, maybe a randomized trial to say, hey, you know, we will decompress or we won't decompress. We won't let the ultrasound kind of affect what we do. And some people, you will change your operative plan and some you won't, to see whether, you know, this will have a real relevance to patients.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what needs to be done. This, you know, this paper is really just a preliminary experience. There's no comparison for this paper. So absolutely agree. You know, the next step that we'd like to work toward is a randomized trial, essentially with and without ultrasound guidance. You know, are there differences long-term, you know, neck pain, arm pain, especially in patients, and how much are these patients going to benefit?
Yeah, I think that would be very helpful. Another question, you know, some of the questions about, you know, decompression, is it enough or not enough, is a little bit subjective. Have you all thought about doing some quantitative analysis of, you know, how much room does that nerve really need? And maybe have it, you know, kind of a quantitative ultrasound, you know, because ultrasound, I think, has been very good qualitatively, but I think that maybe the next step will be some quantitative abilities.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think there's tremendous interest in this. And I think, you know, our industry partners are also very interested in advancing this. And you're right. I mean, we can, the extent of quantification right now that most folks are using is, you know, is there subarachnoid space above and below the cord, you know, a zero or a one, a yes or a no? You know, is there an osteophyte pushing on the nerve root, yes or no? But we definitely have the capability, even, and again, this gets into that question of how much time do you want to devote to this during a surgery? There is the capability to freeze an image and take real-time measurements, measure subarachnoid space, measure the width of the neural foramen, the nerve root sleeve, et cetera. You know, but it's also a really good opportunity to gather important physiologic data. You know, for our patients who are presenting with cervical myelopathy, it's not just a question of decompression, where you're given a tremendous opportunity also to visualize in real time, and in some ways more exquisitely than an MRI can provide, with the nature of the abnormal echogenic signal, can quantify, you know, potentially even the intensity of that, how the volume, the extent of that. And I think that's very applicable to spinal cord injury. And then increasingly in the future, and, you know, folks I know like Dr. Sawai, yourself, and other real leaders in the field, Dr. Christoph Hofstetter, have a big interest in physiologic imaging with ultrasound, assessing spinal cord perfusion. And I think what, you know, this study may potentially open up is now for a physiologic assessment of the nerve root as well.
And one more question, sorry. Does it have the ability to look at things such as blood flow, you know, with the Doppler abilities, or does it not have that?
Does, yeah. Most of these instruments do have Doppler capability. For instance, say you're doing tumor, or you're doing uncinectomy, and you really have a strong interest in knowing precisely where the vertebral artery is, you can visualize that. It's really, the limitation is that, really you can see these medium to larger size vessels quite well. You're not able to assess with standard Doppler ultrasound, for instance, the smaller vasculature of the cord itself at this time. And hence that's where our collective interest in contrast enhancement comes in.
I think another one of the criticisms that will be given by readers and neurosurgeons that are familiar with ACDF who've been doing this exclusively without ultrasound is whether or not the time added is justified by the benefits. From your experience, how much time do you think it does add to the procedure to get the ultrasound set up, to get the relevant images?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a question I definitely welcome. I think the setup for the instruments is very quick. Essentially, the time to turn on the machine and to input patient information, and then mm-hmm. In those cases where you've done your decompression and check and you're happy, then you're done. That's essentially just a few minutes there. If you see a room for additional decompression, and then you start getting into that in an iterative fashion, it could potentially add 10, 15 minutes or so. For me, I definitely welcome this question. I've heard it before, the criticism, well, is this kind of a training wheel for your technique? And I'm more than happy to consider that. I think some, surgeons will say, well, I rely on my technique and my technique is good enough and my patients wake up great and that's good. Not every patient is going to wake up and have a good outcome from surgery in the way you expect. That's just life. So I also trust my technique, but this is another opportunity to verify. We live increasingly in a value-based healthcare system. If I use this for 100 patients, and if it saves me from having to do additional surgery on a few patients, then for me it's time well spent. We place spinal implants and we take X-rays of our implants. I don't think we consider that our training wheels. To me, the neural elements are the most important part of the case, and I like to take advantage of an opportunity to visualize them and have that added confidence to know I'm leaving the operating room having done the work. Now, for ACDF, I think there's a benefit, but what time may show is if there's a real potential role, it may turn out to be for cervical disc arthroplasty. The thing we all fear the most in these cases is we've preserved or perhaps restored motion, and that patient comes back with a new or a worsening radiculopathy, and then we're having to talk about additional surgery. So for mm-hmm. me personally, I'm more than happy to spend a little bit of time.
Yeah, it brings up a good point regarding training wheels, and from a resident perspective, I think anytime there's additional imaging done in the operating room, it's an incredible opportunity for education for us. Certainly when you've seen your first few ACDFs, it can be somewhat disorienting. So I think from an education perspective, there's a lot of value there. Have you seen that your residents are appreciating you bringing this in the OR?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think the residents, pick up ultrasound very quickly, and it's something they carry through with them, throughout their training, and I do agree. I think it also, as you mentioned, is a nice, teaching tool. We work at an academic center. When we're handing the Carison to the resident, it provides a little bit more depth and meaning to, why you're doing what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Vega, do you happen to have any questions?
You know, I've been sitting here having a lot of thoughts on how, you know, this is similar to stuff that I do in the cranial world. And I don't want to take too much time, you know, but what I will say is, you know, there's the use of ultrasound for glioma resection, right? And that whole concept of training wheels, you know, when you start and you're in fellowship, you're using it, you're, you know, it's helping you, you see good resection. Then over years, you get really good at it. And the reality is that you can do it when it's not there, right? And not to say that there's always times when you don't want it, right? There are moments where you're always like, damn, I really wish I can have this right next to me if it's not there, right? And then I'm sure there's certain applications here where there might be, you know, a very bony case that you have to drill out fully. And it'd be really nice to just confirm, you know, with the ultrasound. And so, again, for me, it's about pushing new technologies, trying to find applications. And I think this is a good one to have in your armamentarium at the end of the day. You know, so it's nice to open up, you know, somebody's eyes to something new. So I like it.
Yeah. Well, we have a few minutes left. I want to ask an open-ended question for you, Dr. Chris Kiss. We talked about how this probe was initially used for transsphenoidal pituitary surgery, and you've now repurposed it for this technique. Seems that most of the probes we're using in neurosurgery are just repurposed probes, specifically in spine. You've clearly demonstrated some efficacy here. I'm curious on your opinion on whether we now have enough evidence to justify a redesign and production of a spine-specific ultrasound probe. And in your opinion, what would be the perfect MIS spine probe?
It's a great question. And, you know, you know, ultrasound in medicine, you know, obstetrics, increasingly other fields like urology have, you know, played a really large role in the development of ultrasound technologies. And I think it's always good to check in time to time and see what other fields are doing. You know, I think that's important. And I think as neurosurgeons, we certainly owe those fields a great debt. I think, you know, what we're starting to see is that, you know, now neurosurgery itself is starting to contribute toward the development of new ultrasound technology. And you see that in the literature, but you also see that on the industry side, you know, identification of a market of surgeons who have a demand for these technologies that are tailored and optimized for their specific uses. And, you know, the story of ultrasound it's an interesting one in neurosurgery. You see this rise in the use in the 1980s and then, you know, perhaps not as popular in the 90s, 2000s, some publications still. And, you know, I think some of that probably has to do with MRI, you know, becoming, you know, more routinely easily available kind of throughout that time. And, you know, we're seeing, I think, a real renaissance in ultrasound and in neurosurgery. You know, for instance, at shock trauma in, you know, Dr. Mervis and Geisler, they published on this, and it was only going back doing research, I learned that my own institution 30 years ago had been doing this, and they actually created their own grading scale for spinal cord injury based on the echogenic signal they see. And so I think there's a bit of a renaissance in ultrasound and neurosurgery. And I think we're, you know, seeing, you know, in industry is our partners are very interested in collaborating with us. For me, and I've thought about this, you know, I'd be very, as far as the minimally invasive transducer, I'd be interested to see what kind of images you could generate from something of a halfway between an end-fire transducer and a side-fire transducer. So end-fire transducer, meaning the sonographic waves are going to propagate, be transmitted and received collinear with the instrument itself, end-fire being perpendicular. There's something of an oblique halfway between the two. You know, how far out could we really visualize that nerve root? What kind of things could we see? Those are my thoughts.
Yeah, and certainly the future of MIS spine surgery, maybe introducing this into endoscopic spine surgery, the future is certainly bright. And I want to thank you and your team for continuing to push this field forward and helping patients along the way. But unfortunately, it looks like we're just out of time. I want to thank again our esteemed guests for joining us for this month's podcast. As always, the CNS podcast activity is available to claim for 1.5 CME by visiting the podcast page on cns.org. Also, I want to give a friendly reminder that in addition to our podcast being available for listening, we also welcome you to view this episode on YouTube at the CNS YouTube channel, which will have the accompanying figures and hopefully enhance your listening experience. I hope you join us next month for the next Journal Club podcast, and thank you again.